From New York and Durban, South Africa, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The United States and the Colombian government for years, for the last two or three years, have been trying to sell this program as a comprehensive approach that's counter-drugs and it's not counter-insurgency. So there is no, and the fact of the matter is that the AUC, the Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the paramilitaries, have for years been the main beneficiaries of the drug trade.
Secretary of State Colin Powell heads to Colombia in the face of massive opposition to the so-called war on drugs. Relatives of a slain Chilean general sue Henry Kissinger and other U.S. officials in a U.S. court. And we'll talk to women from Kenya and the Sudan about refugees, racism, and slavery, modern day. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. The Environmental Protection Agency has concluded it must adopt a new standard for the amount of naturally occurring arsenic allowed in the nation's drinking water that is at least as tough as the one proposed by the Clinton administration. EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman decided to recommend a stringent new limit after receiving a report from the National Academy of Sciences that found that the health risks posed by arsenic are much greater than previously assumed by the EPA. The decision addresses one of the most controversial environmental decisions the Bush administration has made since coming into office. In March, the administration set aside a Clinton administration regulation tightening the 50-year federal standard for arsenic levels in drinking water from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion. The move touched off criticism from Democrats, environmentalists, and moderate Republicans and prompted a House vote seeking to reverse the action. After receipt of the report, an agency official said that in no case would the EPA propose a standard any weaker than the Clinton administration's 10 parts per billion, while hinting the final standard might be even tougher. The UN Security Council voted unanimously yesterday to lift a three-year-old arms embargo in Yugoslavia, ending the last in a series of military and economic sanctions imposed against the Belgrade government over the past decade. The action marks the UN's formal recognition that Yugoslavia has embraced democratic rule and cooperated by surrendering former President Slobodan Milosevic in June to a UN war crimes tribunal in The Hague. France and Russia, a close ally of Serbia, Yugoslavia's dominant republic, led the campaign to end the arms embargo imposed in 1998 to protest Serbia's military campaign against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. And Iraq said yesterday 8 civilians were killed, 3 wounded, when Western planes attacked farms 105 miles southeast of Baghdad on Sunday with missiles and cluster bombs. A defense ministry spokesperson in London said the aircraft had attacked military targets and the dead and wounded were Iraqi soldiers. But the official Iraqi news agency, citing witnesses, said the U.S. and British warplanes launched their attack when some people in the farming district were about to say midday prayers and others were shopping in a local market, leading to civilian casualties. And Iraq claimed this morning to have shot down a second U.S. spy plane in less than a month. A U.S. military spokesperson said an unmanned plane is missing and its loss is being investigated. Major Brett Morris, spokesperson for a U.S.-British military task force in the Persian Gulf, said the coalition force had lost an unmanned aircraft today, similar to a U.S. spy plane lost last month. This news from Oklahoma. A state appeals court has ordered an indefinite halt to the execution of a Mexican man whose case drew appeals from Mexican President Vicente Fox. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals said the latest appeal by the prisoner, Gerardo Valdez, raised questions about whether his rights were violated under an international treaty that guarantees foreigners the right to contact their consul after an arrest. The panel said the order would remain in effect until the further order of the court. Lawyers for Valdez are seeking a new trial. And this news from Atlanta, Delta Airlines' 20,000 flight attendants have filed enough authorization cards to call an election for union representation with the Association of Flight Attendants. The unionization effort is one of the largest U.S. organizing drives in decades. The union says it's the largest ever union election in the airline industry. Last week, the union filed a complaint against Delta with the NMB, the National Mediation Board, accusing the airline of intimidating and harassing workers trying to organize the flight attendants. Anti-globalization activists are planning for protesters to land at Qatar in a flotilla during the World Trade Organization meetings in an effort to halt the launch of a new trade round in what's shaping up as one of the most ambitious anti-globalization protests to date. Organizers are also preparing for demonstrations against stock exchanges and multinational corporations as part of a global day of action on November 9th. This weekend, protest organizers are flying into London from San Francisco, Washington, D.C., southern India, and Honduras to put together funding arrangements and logistical plans for the small convoy of ships, which will head for Qatar. The World Trade Organization yesterday approved the establishment of dispute panels on five separate complaints attacking U.S. trade measures involving steel imports, as WTO members demonstrated their exasperation with what they believe are illegal moves by Washington to protect the troubled U.S. steel industry. The U.S. has already lost four WTO steel disputes brought by the European Union, Japan, and South Korea, as well as a steel-related dispute by the European Union and Japan concerning a 1916 anti-dumping law.
Oh, so much been said, and oh, a little been done. They still killing the people, and they having lots of fun. Killing the people, ooh-wee, having their fun. They just want to be the leader in the hours of the rising sun. But no matter what the crisis is, oh no, oh no matter what the crisis is, do your
Crisis by Bob Marley, here on Democracy Now in Exile, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Colin Powell headed for Colombia yesterday to shore up U.S. support for President Andres Pastrana. His three-day trip to the region comes in the face of mounting popular opposition to the U.S. and Colombia's so-called war on drugs. The U.S. is providing an estimated $1.3 billion in aid to the Colombian military as its contribution to Plan Colombia. The plan, which focuses on aerial fumigation and eradication of coca fields, is opposed by Colombia's neighbors, much of its own population, and international human rights and environmental groups. Many human rights groups say the U.S. anti-drug assistance is a fig leaf for its support of the brutal Colombian military's war against guerrilla groups and civil society organizations. Powell is also expected to announce a resumption of the U.S. anti-drug flights that led to the killing of two U.S. citizens by the Peruvian Air Force in Peru in May. We're joined on the phone right now by Mario Murillo. He is host of the national radio program Our Americas, and he's just returned from a two-month stay in Colombia. Welcome to Democracy Now, Mario.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's great to be on, notwithstanding the fact that you're not broadcasting in New York, where the people who are running the show there seem not to understand the significance of the program and the role that it plays in trying to inform the public.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The significance of Secretary of State Colin Powell's trip.
Well, Colin Powell is basically going there to check on the United States investment. In fact, Mark Grossman, the Subsecretary of State of Inter-Hemispheric Affairs, last week actually called it an investment when he visited down to Colombia with a number of other U.S. delegates. And as you pointed out in your introduction, the investment being $1.3 billion in assistance, primarily military assistance, last year, and now they're talking about the Andean Regional Initiative, which is calling for $880 million for the next fiscal year, which is also primarily going towards Colombia and the military. Now, it's going, his visit is coinciding with a number of major developments, things that we were watching with considerable concern when we were down there. One, of course, is the ongoing protests and the denunciations of this aerial eradication campaign used specifically in the south, the fumigations that are carrying out against the small coca plantations and poppy plantations in the name of trying to stem the flow of drugs. But in effect, it's really having a detrimental impact talking to a number of different communities, a number of different representatives from around the region in Southern Colombia, talking about how it has impacted the environment and the health of the area. So there's a lot of resistance to it, including a number of governors from Southern Colombia who have been mounting pressure on the Colombian government to stop the fumigations. But it's also coming in the wake, or I should say in the midst, of a major military offensive that's being carried out in Southern Colombia in the departments of Meta and in Guaviare province. I was in Guaviare last August, just a few months ago, about a month ago, and this is an area that in 1996 was heavily focused. The U.S. was totally focused on the aerial fumigations there, but it's kind of fallen out of the public spotlight over the last several years, especially in the wake of the Plan Colombia and the focus on Putumayo, a province a little bit to the west of Guaviare. But since August 7th, the Colombian military, with the support of the U.S., has been carrying out a major offensive against guerrilla strongholds in southern Colombia, which has been an area that's totally been controlled by the FARC for many, many years. They're going in there. They're carrying out their aerial raids of communities and of alleged guerrilla strongholds, while the anti-narcotics police are going in and destroying the many drug processing plants in the area. And what this is being presented as to the Colombian public, with great video footage from the Colombian National Television, is that the Colombian government is doing what it has to do to stem the weed of the flow of narco-trafficking, and they're doing it by tackling and attacking directly the guerrillas of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And what they're saying right now is we can continue doing it and we could win this war militarily if only we got a little bit more support, not only from Washington but also from the Colombian Congress and the budget process that's underway right now. So it's no coincidence that Colin Powell is going there to check on U.S. investment as this major military offensive is taking place in the south. And then finally, it also comes as the right wing in Colombia, and especially the military and many sectors of the political ruling class in Colombia, they're calling on an end to the so-called demilitarized zone, which I'm not sure, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, the Switzerland-sized territory in southern Colombia, which has been ceded to the FARC back in 1999 as a way to jumpstart peace talks. And for months now, they've been clamoring to end that, saying that that hasn't led to any concessions on the part of the FARC, and that now it's time for all-out war. And Colin Powell, the same day that I left Colombia just about 2 weeks ago, he was actually quoted as having criticized Pastrana for continuing with this demilitarized zone. So it's no coincidence that he's going there at this point in time.
We're talking to Mario Murillo, again, host of the radio program that airs around the country, Our Americas, just back from Colombia. Mario, on the front page of the Washington Post today, murders follow a massacre. Colombian militia targets investigators. Scott Wilson writes, less than 3 weeks before she was shot twice in the face and left to die near her front porch, Yolanda Paternina feared that perhaps she'd gone too far. "They're going to kill me," she told a colleague in the Attorney General's office. Her prediction came true in the early evening of August 29th, crossing the street in front of the house where she rented a room. The 50-year-old prosecutor and mother of two turned to answer a stranger who called her name. The man fired twice, then walked to a waiting motorcycle and roared away. With those shots, Paternina became the third member of the Attorney General's office to die or disappear this year while investigating the January massacre of 26 people by a paramilitary force in the village of Chingue. Two undercover agents investigating the crime disappeared in May at a paramilitary roadblock and are presumed dead. They're talking about the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC, the right-wing paramilitary group that often works in tandem with the Colombian military, now on the State Department's terrorist list. Can you talk about them and the significance of, for the first time, a paramilitary group in Colombia being put on the terrorist list of the United States?
Well, first, to respond to your latest question, the latter question about the fact that it's on the State Department list of terrorist organizations, I think it's necessary. It was absolutely necessary for that to happen, especially given the fact that Colin Powell is going on this very high-profile visit to Colombia. There has been considerable criticism that Plan Colombia is focusing, in the name of the drug war, is focusing too much attention on southern Colombia, and in particular the areas where the FARC are very powerful. The guerrillas are very powerful. So it's been described as a counterinsurgency strategy. The The United States and the Colombian government for years, for the last two or three years, have been trying to sell this program as a comprehensive approach that's counter-drugs and it's not counter-insurgency. So there is no, and the fact of the matter is that the AUC, the Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the paramilitaries, have for years been the main beneficiaries of the drug trade. So for the United States to go into Colombia with such a major military project, they cannot justify that package without calling attention to the role that the paramilitaries are playing, not only in the drug trade, but in human rights violations. Now, in terms of their connections with the military, it's so amazing how over and over again the Colombian media, as well as the U.S. media, in echoing what the Colombian government officials say, refer to apparent links or supposed links or alleged links between the paramilitaries and the Colombian armed forces. And over again, it is clear that those links continue, that those links are very systematic, and that it is part of an overall strategy to win and to gain back major chunks of territory throughout the country. I'll just give you one example. The most recent massacre that was that had such atrocious proportions took place in the Naya, in the town of Alta Naya, which is in the northwest part of Cauca, which is a province in the western part of Colombia, southwestern part of Colombia. That massacre, there were 22 people who were killed, hundreds of people who were forcibly displaced as a result of that. The AUC recognized that actually 42 people were killed. So the Colombian government statistics say 22 people were killed. The AUC, Carlos Castaño, the head of the paramilitaries, actually acknowledged that they killed 42 people in Naya, calling it a wonderful act, a glorious act of patriotism. Now, what happened in that situation is very complicated, and it clearly points to the ongoing links between the paramilitaries and the army. The ELN, the other guerrilla organization in Colombia, had carried out a major kidnapping in that area. They brought the people that they had kidnapped to Alta Naya, to the town where this massacre took place. Now, the ELN has a history of operating in that area, and they blend in with the population regularly. So when this kidnapping took place, they took the people there to Naya. The military came in pursuit. They started asking people, they started questioning, interrogating individuals in the community. What happened? Where are they? Where are they holding the kidnap victims? And the people, obviously, for many reasons, wouldn't talk. One, because of security. Two, because it's not easy to point out where they're going to put out, where they're putting kidnapped victims. I mean, it's not like the ELN came in and publicly said, hey, here we have these victims that we've kidnapped. So they couldn't collaborate. And what the military was saying, and I had testimony from dozens of people that I met with when I was down there, that was saying that the military were actually saying, well, if you're not going to collaborate with us, wait till our cousins come here. Then you're going to really have problems. And the cousins, of course, being the right-wing paramilitaries. And what happened just a week later, the paramilitaries came in there and literally massacred hundreds of people. The official statistics remain at 22. The AUC acknowledges 42. But eyewitnesses say because of the constant inflow of traffic in and out of the community, there must have been at least 100 people who were killed, who were chopped up to pieces and left in the mountainside. And the Colombian government is still not able and is still unwilling to truly investigate what happened there in Naya. And if that is not evidence of complete collaboration between the AUC and the military that continues, I don't know what is.
Mario, also the rebel leader, the brother of the FARC's military chief, Herman Briceño, was convicted and sentenced in absentia yesterday to 40 years in prison for the murders of the three American pro-Indian activists in 1999, Terence Freitas, Ingrid Washnawatuk, and Lahaina Gay.
Right, that took place. I mean, it doesn't really have much weight. Granobles is the name of Herman Briceño. That's his kind of war name. I think it's ironic that this guy was given 40 years in absentia, whereas the military commander who was responsible for the massacre of over 40 people in the Chocó region, Del Rio, a military commander, was actually let go by the prosecutor's office because of so-called technicalities. So it's interesting how Colombian justice works in one way or another. But I think it's important to point out the FARC and point the finger at what the FARC have indeed done in a in terms of violations of human rights. And I think that what I saw specifically in Cauca, where I was just about 3 weeks ago, there is a growing concern about the incursions that the left-wing rebels, the guerrillas of the FARC, are carrying out, specifically in indigenous territories in Cauca. They recently killed a major leader from the Indigenous Regional Council of Cauca, who was killed back in June. And as a result of that, the indigenous communities in Cauca organized a massive Congress, an extraordinary Congress, as they called it, to discuss the issues of defense, self-defense in their communities, and resisting all sorts of military incursions from all the different actors in the conflict. And I think the resistance that the indigenous movements are representing, in not only in Cauca, but also in the northern part of Colombia and all around the country on a national level, shows and is an example of the growing resistance not only to the war, but also to Plan Colombia, to many of the neoliberal economic policies which have devastated the countryside, which has led to a statistic somewhere around 85% of all people in the countryside living in abject misery. And they're growing in their resistance. They're joining forces with trade union movements. They're joining forces with the Afro-Colombian populations. They're joining forces with certain sectors of the church, the progressive sectors of the church, with a growing social movement that is autonomous in its scope, but that is very progressive and indeed, I would say, revolutionary in trying to call for a transformation of Colombian society. Now, unfortunately, because of the way the media and the way policymakers set the agenda, their voices are never heard, neither in Colombia nor here in the United States. And all we hear about are the FARC, all we hear about are the AUC, and all we hear about is the Colombian government with its support from Washington.
Mario, we hope to speak to you in the next few days to actually have you in the studio here at the Firehouse in Chinatown to have you play some of the tape that you gathered, interviews you did with people in Colombia in your 2 month stay. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
I would love to do that, and I can't wait to have you back where you belong at the studios of WBAI in New York.
Well, Mario, thanks for being with us. Mario Murillo headed off to Hofstra University in Long Island, where he is a professor of communications. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile. We'll be back in a minute to find out about the latest documents on Henry Kissinger, linking him to the coup in Chile that led to the rise of Pinochet. Stay with us.
And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You could lose more than you ever hope to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand, then you'll know it's too late to change your mind. Cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline. Up and down the Rio Grande, a thousand footprints in the sand reveal a secret no one can define. The river flows on like a breath in between our life and death. Tell me who the next to cross the borderline.
You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The family of Chilean military commander René Schneider, who was killed 31 years ago during a botched kidnapping by right-wing coup plotters supported by the CIA, filed a lawsuit yesterday in U.S. federal court. The suit accuses former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, former CIA Chief Richard Helms, among others, of involvement in covert operations that led to Schneider's assassination. The suit became possible because of documents declassified in the last few years, which showed that the United States and Henry Kissinger were more deeply involved than was previously thought in a 1970 plot to prevent the democratically elected President Salvador Allende from taking office. The CIA plotting did not prevent Allende, who'd won a September 70 presidential election, from taking office, but right-wing officers did kill Chilean General René Schneider, who opposed a military takeover. The U.S. finally succeeded in ousting Allende 3 years later, leading to a military takeover by Augusto Pinochet. We're joined on the phone right now by Peter Kornbluh, who's a senior analyst at the National Security Archive and author of the forthcoming book, The Pinochet Files. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's a pleasure to be back, Amy.
Good to have you. Can you talk about the significance of this case brought by military commander René Schneider's family?
Yeah, in some ways it was inevitable after the arrest 3 years ago in London of General Augusto Pinochet that the momentum of kind of the globalization of justice would come back to the United States, particularly in the case of events in Chile. And those events, horrible as they were, started really with the October 22nd shooting of the head of the Chilean Armed Forces, General René Schneider. He was the equivalent to the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff here in the United States of America. Richard Nixon had ordered the CIA to foment a coup to block Allende from actually being inaugurated in the fall of 1970. Henry Kissinger was overseeing the implementation of those orders, and Schneider stood in the way. And this case really is the most concrete documented case of U.S. involvement in the assassination of a foreign leader abroad, and the paperwork on this case goes right up to the office of Henry Kissinger.
Now, Kissinger has always denied that the U.S. had anything to do with the killing of General Schneider. What do the documents say?
Well, Kissinger seized on a little twist in this plot, which is that he had told the CIA on October 15th, 7 days before the shooting, that it should not work with a particular coup plotter named Roberto Villo, because he would launch a coup without the capability of following it through, and that would ruin the chances for the other coup plotters that the CIA was working with inside the military to have a successful coup. So the CIA went to VO on Kissinger's orders and said, we think you should suspend your activities for now and work more closely with other Chilean plotters. And in fact, that's exactly what VO did. There wasn't two separate groups of coup plotters, one that the CIA wasn't working with after October 15th and one that they were. They were all working together. Kissinger, I believe, according to the declassified documents, misrepresented what he told the agency to do. He claimed in his testimony to a Senate committee in 1975 and to the American public in his memoirs that he had cut off all coup plotting, when in fact all he had done is said, this one particular individual we can't trust to complete this mission. And the documents certainly reinforce the fact that he did not cut off all coup plotting, and that his office and his deputy, who was then Alexander Haig, was briefed by the CIA after October 15th on the progression of coup plotting, and that even on the day of the shooting, October 22nd, we've learned from declassified documents, the CIA went up to Haig's office. Of course, this is the way they communicated with Kissinger, by talking to his deputy. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon after the shooting, briefed Haig on what had transpired. And so I think it's clear that Kissinger's office did know what was happening, and that's important to this case.
Kissinger recently agreed, after years of delays, to release to the public several thousand pages of his telephone transcripts from this period. Have you seen them, and what do they say?
Well, that's not quite what he agreed to. He agreed to transfer transcripts of telephone conversations that he had during his tenure as Secretary of State, which didn't begin until 1973. He did not agree to transfer the records that he has in his personal possession during his 10 years as National Security Advisor to Richard Nixon between 1968 and 1969 and 1973. And those are the documents which would further reveal his knowledge and involvement in this particular criminal act.
How does he justify releasing one set but not the other?
Well, he didn't voluntarily agree to return those papers. He was under the threat of a lawsuit from my organization, actually the National Security Archive, against the State Department and the National Archives for failing to secure those papers. And so those two agencies went to Kissinger and said, you know, we are being threatened with a lawsuit, and the lawsuit has merit. We are going to have to come after these papers from you unless you return them. And he, at that point, this was just a few weeks ago, did agree to return the State Department papers. The State Department was willing to pursue him for the papers that he took while he was Secretary of State. But so far, George Bush's National Security Council has been reluctant to take the same position, that they should pursue the papers from the national security era of Henry Kissinger's role in government.
What is the precedent for suing an individual? Here you have Renee Schneider's son, who is suing individuals, Richard Helms, former CIA chief, Henry Kissinger. Can they protect themselves by saying they were working for the U.S. government?
Well, they certainly can, and very few former U.S. officials have ever been successfully sued for what could be considered crimes committed under the guise of national security. Some years ago, the family of Charles Horman, the journalist who was killed in Chile following Pinochet's coup by the Chilean military, did file a suit, a wrongful death suit, against Kissinger and the former ambassador to Chile and others, alleging that through neglect and complicity, they were involved in the coup and allowed Charles Horman to be killed. That suit was dismissed for lack of concrete evidence. But that was an American family suing in American courts. And this is a Chilean family kind of pursuing the precedent set by the Pinochet case, that there should be a broader level of jurisdiction, and that crimes committed by officials, in this case a very specific crime, should be able to be tried in other courts. And the case will have to be read and followed legally and stand on its own merits, but certainly this case was allowed by kind of change in international dynamics following the arrest of Augusto Pinochet in London.
We're talking to Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at National Security Archive and author of the forthcoming book, The Pinochet Files. Can you talk about what you're coming out with in your book?
Well, among the things that are in the book is a very detailed account with all of the CIA and U.S. government documents of the shooting of General Schneider and the cover-up that ensued thereafter. And one of the key elements that's in the book that your listeners should know is that for more than 25 years, the CIA and perhaps Kissinger as well deceived the American public into thinking that they had washed their hands of the group that actually shot Schneider before the shooting took place. But one of the things that emerged through the declassification of these documents over the last couple of years was that after the shooting took place and after Schneider had been killed, the CIA passed $35,000 to elements of the hit team that killed him in order to buy their silence about previous contacts with U.S. government personnel, with CIA covert agents. And this was essentially hush money. It was clear obstruction of justice to cover up a very specific crime, which everybody who was cognizant of the U.S. role in it understood to be a very, very, very bad situation for the United States. For all the scandal that has surrounded the whole broader issue of U.S. involvement in an assassination of foreign leaders, For all the focus that's been put on the attempted assassination by the CIA of Fidel Castro, for example, the most concrete case of U.S. involvement in a political assassination is this case of General René Schneider. And that is in the book, as well as an account of Operation Condor, the Chilean Pinochet-led multinational murder operations against political dissidents and opponents of regimes in the Southern Cone. The documents that show how the United States supported General Pinochet after he took power and the degree of their clear, detailed knowledge of his repression and support for him nevertheless. The case of Charles Horman, a number of other cases as well. So those are all in the book.
The 60 Minutes on Sunday did a whole piece on René Schneider, said they had a new document indicating the level of involvement of Henry Kissinger. But there was also documents that they didn't talk about, but not only the payment after the killing of Schneider, but wasn't there a level of gloating?
Well, yes, and in the 60 Minutes piece, they briefly referred to and used a new document, which is the CIA, at the highest level, after a discussion with Richard Helms, sending a cable to its station in Santiago after the shooting took place, basically commending the station on a job well done. Instead of shock and horror that what was supposed to be a kidnapping turned into a murder, you get a cable based on a conversation with the director of Central Intelligence, who is one of the defendants in this case, saying you did a great job, you did what we had set out to do, you did it under very difficult circumstances. Now keep us posted about how this leads to the coup that we've all been working towards. And that, I believe, reflects the attitude in the U.S. government at the time in response to this shooting, and that is a pivotal document that will no doubt be a factor in this case if it is able to go forward.
Well, Peter Kornblau, I want to thank you very much for being with us, senior analyst at National Security Archive, author of the forthcoming book, The Pinochet Files. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile. We're going to break early. When we come back, we'll be joined by two women from Kenya and the Sudan to talk about slavery, racism, and refugees. Stay with us.
Owned by another person, as a car, a house, or a painting. To live as a piece of property that could be sold. A child, or a mother, a wife, or a husband. To be considered not.
You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile as we continue to break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN World Conference Against Racism officially ended Saturday, but we continue our discussion of grassroots struggles against racism. Last week, I got a chance to speak with two women, one from Kenya, one from the Southern Sudan, about refugees, racism. Agnes Nyoka Peter was with us from the Southern Sudan, now a refugee in Kenya, with the Sudanese Women Christian Mission for Peace, and Atsango Chisoni from Kenya with the women's development organization Akanamawa Africa. We're going to start with Atsango Chisoni. I asked her how the issues brought up at the conference related to real-life experiences of racism in Kenya.
Actually, one of the biggest challenges that we faced was just mobilizing around getting people from Eastern Africa, because I traveled throughout the Eastern African region in preparation for this conference to understand the relevance of the meeting. In respect of Kenya, it wasn't as difficult as with respect to the other countries, because Kenya is a settler colony. That means that we had, during the colonial era, British people that came and who had no intention of leaving. We had an apartheid segregation-like system in which Africans were ranked at the very bottom, Asian people in the middle, and white people at the very top. So in terms of the classical narrow definition of racism, people understood what we were talking about. But people didn't understand that you could apply the concepts of this conference, such as xenophobia and related intolerance, to issues such as ethnic conflict, a lot of which we have had in the country and we've had in the sub-region. It's when we use the broader definition out of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, CIRD, to work with groups within the Eastern African region that people began to really see actually this had a lot to do with their daily lives and issues which they really were not talking about and yet affected them every day. There's also the issue of institutionalized and systemic racism, because under the system that we had in place originally, because we were considered to be at the bottom, African people had less access to education. African women in particular, for instance, were not allowed to study physics at the only high school that served African girls. So if you look at the proportion of African female scientists as compared in Kenya to African male scientists, and if you look at the proportion of those scientists as compared to non-African scientists, you'll find that African scientists are in a minority and the women are in an even smaller minority. And so there are a lot of issues around how we now have institutionalized poverty for those particular categories of people in the country.
Agnes Nyoka-Peter, you're with Sudanese Women Christian Mission for Peace in southern Sudan, though right now you are living in Kenya as a refugee. The name of the overall conference in Durban is the UN World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. Do these concepts relate to you as a refugee from southern Sudan in Kenya?
It relates to me as a refugee who have been staying in Kenya for 10 years. There's too much to talk on this conference on the side of refugee women and how the children are suffering. Especially in Kenya, we Sudanese refugees stay far from a place where it is a desert, and it takes us 2 days to come to a town, which is Nairobi. And from that end, you cannot see south, you cannot see east, you cannot see north, even central. We are just in a desert where we share water. You take a bucket of water in a day, and we don't have traveling permits from the camps to the town. It takes us time to get these traveling permits. And when we are coming, every day, each day, a refugee is in put into a jail because he doesn't have a permit to come to town. And access to education is not enough as a refugee. First priority, you see that we are mixed up with the Kenyans in the area where especially where Turkanas are staying and the Sudanese are staying. And when you put the Southern Sudanese and the Turkana, we look alike. So we still have that problem where to identify which is a refugee and which is a citizen of Kenya. We see that we both face the same problem as the Turkanas and the Southern Sudanese who are in that area. And also there's conflict when we go to fetch water, we find out there's ethnic conflict, tribal conflict, which comes because of water, who comes first, who gets water first. And the other issue is about women. The rape is too much in the camp. No security for women, no security for girls, no security even for our children. When there's this conflict, the situation becomes worse, and the UN takes it as a chance. They don't see things serious. It has become like a political issue within the UN compound, and it has become like economical issue. A refugee is being forced. At least you find out that refugees, if you are poor, then that means that you didn't get anything.
How many people are in the UN-run camps in Kenya from southern Sudan?
Every day we receive refugees coming in from southern Sudan.
Is the number in the thousands?
Yeah, more than that.
Uh-huh. And how many camps are there in Kenya?
We have two camps. We have the Kakuma refugees camp, and then we have Ifo refugees camps.
Can you talk about why you left the southern Sudan?
The issue of southern Sudan is very difficult, and it covers a lot. So for me, to mention it, it's clear that why I left southern Sudan, because there is a war between the northerners and the southerners.
We hear in this country a great deal about slavery in the southern Sudan, and it is an issue of controversy here. Can you describe the situation?
Slavery in southern Sudan is still going on as I'm talking to you now. It's still going on in the northern Bargazal, the area where slavery is being undertaken. And it's between the northerners and the southerners.
What does slavery in the southern Sudan, how does it affect women in particular?
Slavery affects us as, in the southern Sudan, we are the indigenous people of the Sudan. And it has become that we are divided now. We are in the southern Sudan, and slavery is taking place, and it has affected many of us. As I'm talking to you now, our children and our women are being taken from they are being displaced from their homes because of slavery, and they are being bombed and then scattered from all over. So you don't find your ways. You end up being taken as slaves, and at the end of the day, family don't meet together. Family reunion becomes very difficult, and it keeps on coming every day and every day. It's very, very difficult for southern Sudanese to express themselves or to come out and say something. It's very difficult as southern Sudanese for our voice to be heard. It can be heard, but the government of Sudan is here. So it is for us southerns, we come through the NGOs. So when we speak, it is put in the document of the declaration of the NGOs. But personally, we find it very, very difficult even to talk, because on the side of us southern Sudanese, we are not a government.
Let me ask Itsango Chasoni of Kenya. You come from a country where you have a leader, Daniel Arap Moi, who've been in place for many years, known for human rights abuses, for, when getting World Bank money and Western support, pocketing a lot of that, known for corruption as well. How do you, as a woman political activist, deal with this when it's the voice of the government that's represented at this world conference?
The voice of the government and the voice of the citizens of Kenya.
I'm going to interrupt this tape conversation that we're having with two women, one from Kenya, one from the Sudan, Itsango Chasoni, just answering this question because of the latest news. Just a little while ago, actually, during this broadcast, we heard a loud explosion, and we heard ambulances, or rather we heard sirens. Well, it appears that planes crashed into the upper floors of both World Trade Center towers minutes apart this morning in a horrific scene of explosions and fires that left gaping holes in the 110-story buildings. No immediate word on injuries or fatalities in the twin disasters which happened just around 9 o'clock, New York time, and President Bush has called the World Trade Center crashes an apparent terrorist attack. The FBI is investigating reports that two plane crashes at the World Trade Center are the result of foul play. A senior government official speaking on condition of anonymity said the agency is pursuing reports that one or both of the planes were hijacked and that the crashes may have been the result of a suicide mission. The source stressed the reports are preliminary and officials do not know the cause of the crashes. Now, the latest news that's coming from CNN right now in Washington, D.C., that there is a huge plume of smoke also at the Pentagon. Possibly a plane hit the Pentagon as well. And that there is a fire there, as well as a fire on the mall. And CNN is showing scenes right now of a fire behind the old executive office building. As we speak, the White House is being evacuated. The Pentagon is being evacuated. Again, the latest news that we have, and this is all unfolding as this broadcast takes place, planes have crashed into the upper floors of both World Trade Center towers minutes apart this morning, just about 9 o'clock. Brad Simpson, our producer, is right next to me. Brad, why don't, instead of you writing a note, tell us what you have also heard.
We just heard on CNN that the Federal Aviation Administration has just suspended all air traffic at all airports around the United States. Planes are not taking off. I assume they're still landing. But all air traffic around the United States has been temporarily halted by the FAA.
And you may hear in the background the sirens. We're in Chinatown. We're not far from the World Trade Center buildings. Again, we did hear the explosion just a little while ago. We're talking about two explosions in both towers of the World Trade Center where we see plumes of smoke. People are stopping everywhere. The emergency vehicles are racing down to the World Trade Center. It appears that planes crashed into these buildings. And in Washington, the news of fire at the Pentagon, on the mall, the White House being evacuated, as well as the Pentagon. George Bush, the president in Florida right now. Large holes visible in the World Trade Center. As one witness told CNN, I was watching TV, heard a sonic boom. The side of the World Trade Center exploded. Debris is falling like leaflets. I hear ambulances. The northern tower seems to be on fire. The tops of the twin towers were obscured by the smoke. Thousands of pieces of what appeared to be office paper came drifting over Brooklyn, about 3 miles from the tower. The center bombing on February 26, 1993, killed 6 people, injured more than 1,000 others. In 1945, an Army Air Corps B-25, a twin-engine bomber, crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building in dense fog for a little history. The president in Sarasota, Florida, spoke briefly on his way back to Washington, D.C., again, as you just heard, Brad Simpson reporting from television that the FAA has suspended all flights around the United States. Plumes of smoke in Washington, D.C., as the White House is being evacuated, as the Pentagon is being evacuated. All flights around the United States are suspended for at least 7 hours at this point. Not clear exactly what is happening. First, one plane hit the World Trade Center building, it appears, and then another plane. And the question was, were these planes hijacked? Again, this news is just coming out as this broadcast goes on. Smoke pouring out of the upper floors of the World Trade Center. Broadcast reports planes have struck it. Miranda Kennedy is here as well, who is helping out with today's broadcast. Miranda, can you tell us what you've just learned?
Well, we just learned from CNN that the president is actually on a plane, on an Air Force One plane, heading back to D.C., where the White House has been evacuated and there's fires all over the Washington Mall.
Washington Mall, there are fires. At the Pentagon, there's a fire. CNN made some mention of possibly a plane also hitting the Pentagon. In the background, you may hear the emergency vehicles where we're broadcasting from right now on Lafayette Street in downtown Manhattan, not far from the World Trade Center building. The news is coming out as we speak. Unusual information about being 3 miles away in Brooklyn, hearing witnesses say thousands of pieces of what appeared to be office paper came drifting over Brooklyn about 3 miles from the tower. Again, what have you heard, Miranda?
We just learned that it was actually a plane who hit the Pentagon as well as the World Trade Center towers. So they don't know what the origin of the plane is yet, obviously.
So a plane hitting the Pentagon, a plane hitting the World Trade Center towers, perhaps two planes hitting the upper floors of the World Trade Center, minutes apart in a horrific scene of explosions and fires on television now. They're showing the pictures of the World Trade Centers that are the upper floors are engulfed in smoke. And again, at the same time, fires at the Pentagon being evacuated, the White House being evacuated, and fires on the malls. We're going to go to music for 1 minute as we gather more information. This information obviously is coming out as we learn of it. Miranda, what else have you learned?
The Capitol, the Treasury, the White House, and the Pentagon have all been evacuated. They're saying that they've pushed everyone in the downtown area of D.C. back to as far as 8th Street. So there seems to be crowds of people being evacuated and pushing far back.
You can hear the latest information again. Fires in New York as a result of plane crashes into the World Trade Center, plane crashing into the Pentagon, White House being evacuated, Treasury being evacuated, Pentagon being evacuated. President Bush is coming up from Sarasota. He spoke briefly. They were checking out Air Force One, and then he was coming on that flight. But again, all over the country now, flights have been suspended for at least 7 hours. Miranda?
Now what they're saying is that it's obviously a terrorist attack and that they're investigating into connections with Osama bin Laden.
Now, of course, in these preliminary reports, all sorts of information is put out, as you may well remember from the Oklahoma City bombing. I painfully remember talking about the suggestions of who it was when in fact it wasn't. So we are not going to draw any conclusions at this point, just reporting the information of the planes crashing into the World Trade Center buildings, the plane crashing into the Pentagon, a fire at the Pentagon right now, the White House being evacuated, other government buildings being evacuated, fires on the mall in Washington, D.C. And right now, as we listen, we can hear emergency vehicles racing to the World Trade Center. Go ahead, Miranda.
Just on this terrorist attack, the Secret Service reports that because the White House was evacuated, it offers a credible threat of a terrorist attack, but that's as much as they know.
And so this information coming to you, New York time, just before 10 o'clock, it appears it's all taken place in this past hour. I don't know if the mics are picking up all the sound outside, but major mass moving of emergency vehicles down to the World Trade Center, which is very close, in fact, to where we are right now. The pictures on TV, the smoke, the plumes of smoke above the World Trade Center, both all the upper floors of the World Trade Center buildings, the towers of the World Trade Center, are engulfed in smoke. No immediate word right now on injuries. The FBI obviously is investigating. These are the same towers that were struck by bombers in February of 1993. Plane was coming in low. It looked like it hit at a slight angle. It is not clear whether this plane was hijacked. Large holes are visible in the sides of the 110-story buildings, the landmark Twin Towers. Again, we heard it here as we were doing the broadcast, not clear whether it was a car accident or something taking place. We clearly know now that the World Trade Center towers have been hit. Miranda Kennedy?
What they're saying from Washington, D.C. is now that either a plane or a helicopter exploded into the Pentagon. It exploded on the outside of the fifth corridor of the building, which is the Army corridor. And witnesses were saying that the whole building just exploded. Obviously, it's been evacuated now, and we don't know if there have been any injuries.
And it is, as we speak, 9:59 in the morning, New York time. As we go off the air, we assume we'll continue simply to keep the line open if any of the programs want to continue with us. Again, we're just getting this information as it comes off the wires and listening to the emergency vehicles where we are, very close to the World Trade Center building, and broadcasting to you what we're hearing on television as well. This all happened within the last hour. The World Trade Center towers, both engulfed in a in plumes of smoke, because it seems that planes have crashed into the upper floors of the World Trade Center towers. In addition to that, plane has hit the Pentagon, causing a major fire there. Evacuation of the Pentagon, evacuation of the White House. There are fires on the Mall in Washington, D.C. All planes have been suspended around the country. Miranda?
It looks like, from the reports on CNN, that the second tower of the World Trade Center has actually been hit again. There's new clouds of billowing smoke. It's completely concealed by smoke. It may just be some fallout, but it's hard to believe that so much explosive smoke has come from that one explosion. So it is actually possible that there's been a second hit on the World Trade Center. As has been said, it has already been hit by two planes early this morning at about 8:15. Two planes crashed into the World Trade Center towers, one after the other. And at this stage, everyone on CNN is really just trying to talk around what's happening.